hope that the sermonette gave all of you pause for thought. It certainly did me, reflecting on the examples that Lewis brought up, in particular the example about the discussion of the cities on the plain, also known as Sodom and Gomorrah, the plain being down in the bottom of the valley of the Dead Sea. We live in an age where dramatically increasingly, because this has been happening for a very long time, what we are experiencing in what he was covering, it was a slide away from a common sense of morality and a common understanding of Scripture. And the reaction of the young lady they described as, it was a fairly tame reaction, I suppose, under the circumstances, based on some that you've heard, undoubtedly, about. But that's as good as it seems the world is getting in so many respects. Run from any confrontation with the truth. Don't want to hear about it. And we watch this trend develop, going back to the 1960s, really. We had our issues and challenges, and you think about Mr. Armstrong's preaching in the 30s, and then, of course, World War II came. That sobered America up. The 30s sobered America up. Well, all right, the 20s sobered America up, but that was a prohibition, but it didn't sober them all by any means. It was, unfortunately, where you add to God's law, and that was an adding to issue. That was one of the worst things that happened to the law-abiding concepts of America, is passing laws that ought not have been passed. But the 1930s and the Great Depression was a sobering time. Probably only a handful of you have any memory of maybe the later part of the 30s, being old enough to be aware of things. But we all have memories of either parents or grandparents who lived through that time and were heavily influenced by the austerity and the trials of the 1930s, depending on where they lived, factored in what kind of trials they went through. If you were in the Dust Bowl, it indelibly printed in your mind the horror of drought and of soil in the wind. Then came World War II, the bloodiest war the world had ever seen up to that time. And long before Hiroshima, the atomic blasts of Little Boy and Fat Man, is that the name of the other bomb? We gave the bombs names back in those days. Fat Man and Little Boy. Forget exactly how it went. But whatever the case, that was simply an extension of what man has already been doing. Ever since firearms were invented, the nuclear weapons were simply a logical step. They weren't a horror weapon beyond all horror weapons because, you know what? Tokyo suffered a lot more casualties than Nagasaki or Hiroshima, either one. 100,000 from an incendiary bomb attack from American bombers. 100,000 deaths. And in Hiroshima was somewhere near 70,000. So the Japanese are very tough. In those days, a very tough people. And they weren't about to back down even after that attack on Tokyo. And that attack itself was simply an extension of what was already happening in Germany. Dresden was firebombed, and other cities in Germany. And the logic behind it, when you get into the logic of war, there's always a logic, is destroy the enemy's ability to carry on a war. If you can't literally destroy the army, then you just go behind the army and destroy where they get their weapons. And of course, you're going to then have huge civilian casualties because typically the warmongers will move their people in around those locations. Naturally, they have to because they need their labor force there. So what happened in Germany led directly to the incendiary bombing of Tokyo. That did not get the attention of the Japanese leaders, and so then came the super weapon that had been developed, which was simply a bigger bomb. Yeah, definitely a lot bigger bomb, and but it wasn't beyond the pale. It was simply a logical step, and a sad logical step in man's history, as so many other steps have been. So it made an impact, and that kept America somewhat sobered by in the 1950s, coming out of the war, and then the Korean War that followed. And through the 1950s, though, that just the grip on sober thinking and thoughtful thinking started to slip a little bit, especially in the educational systems is typically where it happens. And then we hit the 1960s, not the early 60s, but the middle 60s. And particularly it seemed to climax in 1968 with the sexual revolution and the drug revolution rolled into one, as the drugs lowered the resistance of those involved in sexual immorality of all sorts. And then that's what we've had ever since. Certain decades, we see a pulling back. The 80s was that, to more of the what we call conservative values from a political point of view, but a values that are more in line with God's way and God's truth. But we see it. We also saw those decades starting in the 70s, because the 60s and 70s were very liberal decades. The intensity of the campus riots and such of the 60s gave way in the 70s to sort of the zoned out potheads, as they called those who smoked too much marijuana. But that became an influencer of the society, and it moved the liberalism of that revolution out of just the younger age group, but then into the population. And so it spread the liberal thinking and the weakness to resist that which is clearly against God's law by others. It affected the church. I remember going to services in Chicago once, and the minister there was wearing a turtleneck and a turtleneck shirt under his jacket, and a big old medallion hanging from the middle of it. He was not long with us, of his own choice, but yeah, it was certainly indicative. The 70s was one of those times. It was pulled back at the end of the 70s. The 80s was a more conservative time indeed. Then we came to the 90s. In the 1990s, began to be very liberal in America. Yeah, obviously, look at leadership at that time. We're not surprised. Just like in the latter part of the 70s, the same kind of leadership, except it was worse in the 90s by far. And that affected the church. And remember what we went through 20 years ago. It was a very sobering time for God's people. And seeing people that had a grip on the standards of God's way, losing that grip, losing the reasoning capability from Scripture to the point that you wonder if they ever really had it. And that case can be made in a lot of cases. Maybe they never really had it. But we soldiered on. Then we had, fair stability in United in the next decade. But we see the same attitudes in society that we saw in the 90s, that we saw in the 70s, and also in the 60s, we see those same attitudes brewing in society. They will have, and they are having, an effect on us. And the key is to keep our minds clearly on God's way of life, clearly on His Scriptures. What does the Bible teach us? That's our standard. If that means I need to change this or I need to change that, well, that's what repentance is all about, isn't it? We went through that when we were preparing for baptism and committing our life to Christ and the Father, and being willing to change, eager to change, happy to change in some cases because, terrible lifestyles of the past, sinful ones, it's so much nicer when you don't do those things that make you sick or cause damage in your life and others. So this sermon then kind of fits in with that, is simply a question for the title, How Do We Keep the Sabbath Holy? This is going to be a mainstay of our faithfulness to God and our true Christianity, is how do we keep the Sabbath holy? I mentioned the 70s, what we saw in that one particular service. a long time ago in a congregation far, far away. That wasn't the only one that we saw that. The grip and the belief that the Sabbath service is a holy time before God and that the Sabbath itself is a holy time before God, this is where we report to God the Father and Jesus Christ, you know, personally, you know, physically personally and spiritually as well, along with our brethren. This time of the week is a vital and critical time of the week, the most critical. As we go forward into the dangers of our age, as Lewis was bringing out, we have got to have our armor on, if you will, the spiritual armor. This is where we come and polish it and strengthen it and develop the camaraderie among brethren of like mind. And good camaraderie, a strong esprit de corps. I don't know why we have to use the French word, but, you know, nothing against the French. They came up with some really good phrases. And the spirit of the body is what esprit de corps means. We want the God's spirit. That's the spirit of the body of Christ, of the church. We want that. We want that interaction that develops it and enhances it, which is part of the vital aspect of being at God's Sabbath service. So how do we keep the Sabbath holy? I think it would be good if we look at this. This isn't the be-all and end-all. In fact, as I was preparing this, I realized, you know, I haven't given a sermon on the Sabbath from that perspective either. So I want to go back, and sometime in the next few months we'll have another Sabbath sermon. But this one is how we do it at services and before and after church services. You know, as the Sabbath, the sun begins at sundown on Friday, ends at sundown on the Sabbath itself. And so we have a serious chunk of time. So just to do an overview on that and to consider it, let's turn first of all to the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20. The Ten Commandments. The great controversy of the Ten Commandments in America today. And yet, it wasn't a controversy back in the day. I love that phrase, the way we use it in Ohio, back in the day. We know what day that was, we figure. Now, it was the Founding Fathers' Day is when it was. It carried on beyond then. I mean, they didn't build the Supreme Court building in the days of the Founding Fathers. They did build the White House, well, at least the first version of the White House, and then the British burned it down, naughty on them. So it had to be rebuilt. But we have it plastered all over our legal buildings, courthouses. The Supreme Court building, it's cut into the stone. They are the statutes, because the word statutes carries the meaning in Hebrew of being engraved. So it's engraved into the stone there and in other places too. The Ten Commandments were the core. And you think, well, why weren't they all Sabbath keepers then? Well, they weren't called to understand the Sabbath. By the way, there were a lot of Sabbath keepers in the early America. And they weren't necessarily out on the frontier, but they were there. They normally get lumped under a grouping called the Seventh-day Baptists. And they're called Baptists not because they're in any way connected to the Baptists of today. It's because they believed in baptizing. The church, this is a digression, if you want to make that a note, digression. If you go back to the 1500s, at the time that the Amish, well, not the Amish, but before that, the Mennonite movement was getting started. The Amish came a little bit later, but it was a part of the Mennonite movement. The Mennonites were called Anabaptists, which is the A-N-A on the front of the word Baptist, means again baptize. And that was the label they got from the Roman Church, because the Roman Church baptizes people when they're babies. And if you baptize adults, you're baptizing again, and that's a heresy, we're going to kill you. And they did. Lots of people. That was their way back in those times. God's true church would also have been known as Anabaptists in that. They had been Anabaptists a long time before Menno began his movement and his revival to a certain degree of what he understood of God's way. You know, there were a lot of people that were very brave. They didn't have full knowledge of God's way, but certainly they were brave and stood up for what they did know. And, you know, that's a blessing on their heads in that sense. But as we move forward through the Reformation in Europe, and then it moved over to England. England's Reformation came a little bit later, and it continued longer because in the Reformation in England, they booted out the Catholic Church, replaced it with the Anglican Church, the Church of England. I'll call it the Episcopal Church over here. And then there was a movement against the Anglican Church by those who wanted to go further than what the Anglicans had done. Because basically they said that the Pope wasn't the head of the church, the King of England was. That was one of the main things, and a lot of the doctrines otherwise were the same. Well, the Sabbath-keeping movement moved to England, and then eventually it made the jump in the 1600s over to America. Stephen Mumford in Rhode Island was one of the first to come, but there were many others who came over time. And we'll do a Bible study series on that, or a PowerPoint presentation. Sometimes PowerPoints are good where you can get a picture of charts and things. The Seventh-day Baptists came out of that eventual movement. And so the Seventh-day Baptists were active in early America. There were some who knew large sections of God's truth and with whom God was directly working. Seventh-day Baptists gave way eventually in the mid-1800s, almost about 1860, to what became known as the Church of God Seventh-day. Both organizations still exist, by the way. Both nominally keep the Sabbath. One, I think, a little bit more than the other one. But they have certainly downplayed any connection to the holy days. As we know, the Church of God Seventh Day, and the controversy in the 1930s regarding that, Mr. Armstrong. But neither one writes much even about the Passover, because they both did believe in the Passover. We used to live near the headquarters of the Seventh-day Baptist movement. I mean, we lived right in the town where it was, and it was quite an interesting time in visiting with that. But the Sabbath was a key feature. It's a part of the Ten Commandments. It's right there. And that's what we want to read right now, to go to the Sabbath and look at that. It's in verses 8 to 11. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And in the remember part, the Sabbath was given very early in man's history. It was given the day after man was created. God created the Sabbath as a divine institution of time. So it's holy time for the entire 24 hours of the Sabbath. And by holy time, it means God's presence is in it. This is the day he set apart. He made it for mankind so we could rest, and he made us to have a biological rhythm that needs a seventh-day rest. He created us that way. He made the Sabbath for us to stop and contemplate him, to stop our regular work and contemplate him and think about his way and study his word and pray more than we would normally have time to do. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, sacred, dedicated to God. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but on the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Eternal your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. And what's the basis of it? The basis goes back to Genesis 2, we alluded to already. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. He created this time, this set-apart time. Now the annual holy days, we have the first day of unleavened bread, the last day of unleavened bread, Passover service, interestingly, isn't a holy day. Did you know that? Or did you ever think about that? It is one of God's commanded assemblies that isn't a holy day. But it's just one of the anomalies that God created into it. But you have the first and second days of unleavened bread. You have Pentecost. Of course, the Feast of Trumpets and Atonement, first day of the Feast of Tabernacles. And then the last great day, or the eighth day, that are all annual Sabbaths, all based on the strength of the Sabbath commandment, because they too are Sabbaths. So It's a marvelous thing that God has done, and we understand it. And we understand, you know, I recited those days, and in your mind, immediately, you start thinking, oh, yes, I know what each of those means. You know, I've learned that. It's become a part of my fiber, as it were, my knowledge base, and more than the knowledge base, an understanding base, and beyond understanding has become a part of your wisdom in following God all the years that you've known and followed God. And in, if you're new to the faith, you can see it sinking in almost weekly, the understanding, layering it on until it all comes right back to your mind. So let's look then how we apply the how we keep the Sabbath holy. Obviously, we don't work. We don't do hobby work, even on the Sabbath. So what do we do? What do we do? What do we not do? This is a basic sermon. Well, it is a time for some study and reflection on God, of His Word and His way. Study that we usually don't have the time to do on other days. And we can find ourselves too busy doing whatever it happens to be, even on the Sabbath, to take the time to do that. But that has to be a time of added study. And bear in mind, sometimes your Bible study isn't just with your nose in the book. When you have remembered something in the Scripture and you sit and meditate about it and think about it, even if you look up a passage to refresh your memory, you know, meditative Bible study is Bible study as well. The Sabbath is not a time for us to watch sports and entertainment programs. You know, they're always lurking there behind us on the tube. But it's a time for some more prayer, more thoughtful prayer. We're not as quiet, we're not as rushed on the Sabbath. It's a time to be aware of the society around us. To a degree, we monitor this all the time. But like the sermonette did, it elaborated on a principle that I think is applicable in the Sabbath message in Luke 21. Let's turn back to Luke chapter 21. Luke 21, by the way, is a parallel chapter to Matthew 24 and Mark 13. Those are called the Olivet Prophecies, not because they're named after a lady named Olivet, but because they were given, the prophecy itself was given by Christ from the Mount of Olives, looking back at Jerusalem. Jerusalem was immediately to the west across this deep canyon, which is called the Valley Kidron, and that's why it's called the Olivet Prophecy when you read about it in something. So in verse 36 of Luke 21. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted to as worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. And this chapter in Matthew 24 and Mark 13 recite a lot of the key events that will take place leading up to and during the final war of mankind in this age, the Great Tribulation. And that's not only man fighting the war, but God will then intervene in the latter part of it, which is the beginning of the day of the Lord. So we are to watch, therefore, and pray always. The watching part, being aware, monitoring what's happening in the world, taking stock of the events of the week. So sometimes we watch the news. Sometimes you've heard enough of the news to be aware of it quite thoroughly. But that's a part of being worthy, and that's certainly a Sabbath aspect. Sometimes reflecting on God as Creator, and if you can find a documentary program on the creation or on Bible history. We watched a part of one after we got home from last week. It was on the book of Job. And I think we watched about half of it. The other half we'd seen at another time. But it was one of those almost predictable programs because the producers of it don't really believe. You know, they ridiculed Job and what a crazy man he was and that kind of thing. And we were watching it to see what their arguments were and to see if they had any shred of useful historical understanding. They had a couple shreds, but that was about it. Otherwise, you were mounting a defense of what you learned about Job. Job was a great man who did live during the time of the patriarchs, a very great man, and worthy of our study of his life from time to time. So watching an occasional documentary on something like that on the Sabbath is also a benefit. It's not a time, as I said, for watching sports or for doing sports. It's a day of rest. When you have children, and many of you already knew this, you have Sabbath, some, especially for smaller children, some certain Sabbath toys that they don't get to play with very much during the week, but they get to play with them on the Sabbath as they reinforce some aspect of God's way. So that's another aspect of it. It's a time for meditation and thinking. Those are some of the things that we do before we ever get to services and even after services, how we consume our time on the Sabbath. Let's turn to Matthew 12 and look at some of the service aspects of the Sabbath. Matthew 12, in this instance, we'll begin in verse 1. It culminates in the fact that Christ is Lord of the Sabbath. He is the master of the day. And what he taught about the Sabbath is what we do. Verse 1, at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath." You know, they were picking grain, heads of corn. In the King James, I used to read this in the King James, and I don't know if you have the King James, but it says corn instead of grain. Well, I didn't know until I was 19 or 20 that in England they call all grain corn, and they call corn maize. So I was ignorant of that, and I always wondered, what are they doing? They're snapping roasting ears off of corn stalks to say, well, how do you eat that and not get squirted with corn milk all over the place? I've tried. It's why I like to have them cooked first. But we grew 5 acres of that stuff every year, right along with our field corn. And if you were in a low blood sugar time and you need a little energy, and any either field corn or sweet corn was in the roasting ear, we would sometimes go find a smaller ear and gnaw on it a little bit to get a little bit of energy to keep on putting up the hay or whatever we were doing at the time. So here we have them plucking the heads of grain. This would be wheat or barley or spelt. Possibly spelt. I don't know that wheat was actually developed yet, but it's related to spelt. But they were plucking those, and you think, well, how do you eat those? Well, you snap the head off, and then you roll it in your hands just like this. And what you're doing is you're breaking the kernel out of the husk. And then as you're doing it, you just let the husk part of the head of grain to fall on the ground, and then you pick the kernels up and eat them. Or if you're good at it, you blow on it and then throw them all in your mouth and chew on them. And they're delicious. Even hard grain, I don't chew hard grain anymore. Teeth don't like that. But back in the day we did, and you chew on wheat and pretty soon you've got gum. Doesn't taste like regular gum, but it's nutritious. These were probably not quite ripe heads. And whatever the case, they were doing that. You think, well, that was beat. They're stealing that. No, they weren't. That was a law that God had for ancient Israel, that as a traveler would walk by, they can have a heads of grain or a piece of fruit off of your tree as they walk by down the path, and that was fine. And God said, don't you worry about that. I'll make sure you have plenty. That was a part of the similar principle came the law of gleaning, where farmers were told, of all things, you'd think God would be insisting that we be very neat and tidy in all that we do. And he does, except for harvesting. Be sloppy. As you come along and you got a corner of the field over there, that's too far to walk. Leave it alone. Just let it stand. That poor folks can come and harvest that. That'll be called the gleaning. And when you're putting, they were doing this all by hand with scythes and then tying up the batches of grain. Get careless. Drop some. If it breaks apart, put another one together and leave that stuff laying there. Then the folks behind, like Ruth, if you remember Ruth's case, she would come along and glean that. So that was a part of the principle. God allowed those kinds of things to be done. So it wasn't that they were stealing at all, What the Pharisees were complaining is that snapping off the head of grain, rolling it between your hands, and throwing it in your mouth was breaking the Sabbath. The Pharisees were in error. If the Pharisees say something, it's a pretty good bet in the New Testament that whatever they say is wrong. And most of the time what the Sadducees say is wrong as well. The Pharisees were the super strict ones. And Christ was constantly in conflict with both them and the Sadducees, back and forth. Because the truth lay where Christ was. What he taught was the truth, not what they taught. And so he taught in verse 3. Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and he ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat? And you think, why couldn't you eat the showbread? Well, because it was for show. That's why it's called showbread. It was on the tables in the temple. It was a bread that was offered to God. And it laid there on those tables for a certain length of time, and then every several days it would replace it. And so it was dedicated to God, and David was running from Saul, he and his young men with him, and they had no weapons. It was a critical time. You can look it up in the center column if you've got it, and go back and read the adventure of what was happening there. And the priest, the high priest, gave David the showbread. He said, "That's all I've got here." And he says, "Well, David," I need it. We're famished. We've got to have something, or they're going to catch us. And so that was acceptable. That was an emergency circumstance. Or have you not read in verse 5, in the law on the Sabbath, the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Yes, I say to you that this place, in this place, is one who is greater than the temple. Now, the priests profaning the Sabbath. For the priests who were on duty at the temple or the tabernacle before the temple, they worked hard on the Sabbath simply because they had to slaughter a certain number of animals, more animals than usual, for the daily sacrifices. So those who were actually doing that had to do that. And sometimes we can think, we might think, well, whatever, I'm service, you know, from week to week to week, that's just profaning the Sabbath like the priests. Well, take it in balance. The priesthood did not serve on duty all the time. David, in his day, organized the priesthood into 24 courses or divisions, based on the names of certain of the priests, leading priests in his day. And they would serve 1 week at the beginning of the year, and then they would go home. And then toward the end of the year, they would serve another week. And then for the 3 weeks the time surrounding Pentecost and the days of unleavened bread and the feast, they would all be on duty in Jerusalem because they would all be there for the holy days. So they weren't on duty every week. In fact, they were only on duty, regular duty, twice, 2 weeks. And they worked from Sabbath noon to Sabbath noon. And then the next division took over from them. So that they profaned the Sabbath in the sense that they had labor that they had to do for half of the Sabbath. But they only did that 2 weeks out of the year. So it wasn't a constant thing. And so that's important to understand that background of them profaning the Sabbath. Yet I say to you that in this place, in verse 6, there is one greater than the temple. But if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would have been condemned, not have condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath. Christ, that was the point there, Christ is the Lord of the Sabbath. Let's notice a couple of other aspects in understanding the Sabbath and its practical application. Luke chapter 13 and 14 we'll go to next. Starting with Luke 14 or 13. Luke 13, this one begins in verse 10. So Christ is healing on the Sabbath. Now, for Christ to heal on the Sabbath is different than what we would say for a nurse or a doctor to be healing on the Sabbath today. When he was teaching one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, behold, there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity for 18 years and was bent over and could no way raise herself up. But when Jesus saw her, he called her to him and said, "Woman, you are loosed from your infirmity." And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. For 18 years she had been bent over and hobbling along. But the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, and he said to the crowd, "There are 6 days which men ought to work, and therefore come and be healed on them, but not on the Sabbath day." And the Lord answered him and said, "Hypocrite, do not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or donkey from the stall and lead it away to water? So ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan had bound, think of it, for 18 years be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath?" And when he had said these things, all his adversaries were put to shame, and the multitude rejoiced for all the glorious things that were done by him. So there are certain things that are done on the Sabbath. Healing, divine healing, is certainly done. We anoint people on the Sabbath, that's for sure. But the lesson here is that there are also other things. We don't live in an agrarian society today. Very few of us have an ox in the stall or a donkey in the stall. I wish we did. I wish we had more of an agrarian society, a slower pace. You know, I grew up in that and miss it. But we had Sabbath duties. Our livestock had to be fed. We didn't do all of the hard work of that. We prepared before the Sabbath started with as much of it as we could, so we didn't have to transport the hay or silage or whatever it was we were feeding them. We made sure they had their water tanks were full and that sort of thing. But the principle of looking after them, even at Ambassador College, where we had the research farms in Texas and also in England, where I attended, we had Sabbath duties. We took our turn, and there were about 6 or 7 of us, so it was about once every 6 or 7 weeks, to go down and run the cattle, the cows, through the milk stall. We had a system where they were with their calves, and we only milked them once a day. Not sure that's the best system. It's traumatized the calves a lot. But whatever the case, we would milk those that gave more milk than their calves could take, run them through the milking machine. And it would just take a short time to do all of that, but that was in conjunction with this very principle right here. Let's go to chapter 14 and look at another. In addition to certain Sabbath duties that have to be done for the nourishment and the health of livestock as well as humanity, begin in verse 1 of chapter 14. "Now it happened as he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath, and they watched him closely. And behold, there was a certain man who came to him who had dropsy, and Jesus answering, spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees. And he said, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?' And they kept silent. And he took him, and he healed him, and he let him go. And he said to them, 'Which of you, having a donkey or an ox that has fallen into a pit, or a ditch, in the King James, would not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day?' And they couldn't answer him regarding these things, because they knew vugudun well that if they had an ox stuck in a ditch, you know, where it was bogged down in the mud, on the Sabbath, they would pull it out of concern for the animal. Well, Christ was reacting and was healing out of concern for the human being. So we call this the ox in the ditch principle, using ditch instead of pit, because the ditch is what was used in the King James. So those are some principles that we understand in keeping the Sabbath before and after we actually come to the Sabbath service. But now let's look at the Sabbath service and our attitude and our example and the approach that we ought to be taking in that particular regard. Coming before God to keep his Sabbath holy. How important is it that we prepare ourselves for that? And how do we prepare ourselves for that? Now let's look at another story. This is in Leviticus 10. It doesn't say that it happened on the Sabbath, but the principle that we extract from here is very applicable to the Sabbath day. Now, this is really a sad time. Israel had come out of Egypt. They had the golden calf incident, which was a very low point in their early time of their wandering. The tabernacle finally had been built when Moses finally came down from the Mount Sinai with all the directions and the Ten Commandments. And they got the tabernacle built, which was a portable temple, is what the tabernacle was. So you understand its purpose. It had a portable altar of burnt offerings that was outside of it in the courtyard around it. And they had this fence, a very beautiful fence that they elaborately put around it. And then there was another altar that was inside the tabernacle. It was called the altar of incense. And that was also would have been a source of heat in the cool times of the year for the tabernacle, or later the temple. That was where the priests, when they would go to offer certain sacrifices and certain of their duties, they had a censer. Every priest was given a censer, which is a long ladle, an ornate ladle, and they would scoop a hot coal out of the altar of incense. And they would carry that in their hand and have a fistful of a special recipe of ingredients of frankincense and myrrh and other things. One of the families of the Levites was delegated the responsibility to prepare that, the incense, and they had the recipe that God evidently gave them. And they would sprinkle that onto that hot coal, and it would, of course, burn, and it would give off this wonderful and beautiful fragrance inside the temple, or before that, inside the tabernacle. So that's what the priests had to do. Beyond the altar of incense, and off to its wings were the tables where the showbread, the golden tables where the showbread was located. And then there was a curtain. Behind that curtain is where the Ark of the Covenant was located. It was the back, the anteroom, the westernmost room. It was always oriented to the door opening to the east. So at the west end of the building, behind this tapestry, was where the Ark of the Covenant was kept, with the statuary of the angels, the cherubim, the two of them. And cherubim means two, at least two. The IM takes the place of an S in Hebrew. And they were on the top. They were on the mercy seat. The mercy seat was statuary of God's throne. You know, we're not to make images that, purport to be of God. We don't even draw pictures of God based on things that Christ taught. But there was a time when God instructed that statuary of two angels and of the divine throne to be made, but they were only there on the mercy seat, which was the covering of the Ark of the Covenant. So that was where that was all located. So they... What we have here is the story of Nadab and Abihu. Aaron was the high priest. He was the brother of Moses. The priesthood would only descend through Aaron, not through Moses or Aaron's other brothers. The Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it and put incense on it and offered profane fiber. This is Leviticus 10 and verse 1, or am I in verse 2 yet? Offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. There were very strict orders of how the priests would approach the tabernacle and therefore approach God on behalf of the people. Very strict orders. And they had uniforms that they wore, linen uniforms, when they were on duty. And that, you can read about the vestments of the priesthood in Exodus 39. The whole chapter covers it. You can go back to Ezekiel, and you can read about it even in more detail, because that speaks of the time when there will be a temple in Jerusalem during the millennium, the latter part of Ezekiel. But Exodus 39 would cover this one. And it's an interesting read. So here they were dressed, but they offered profane fire. There was something wrong with what they did, and they knew what it was. You know, they knew they were not doing it right. And it was not what God had commanded. So they were going either beyond what he said or didn't do what he said. Either way. So fire went out from the Lord and devoured them. They were struck dead. Not necessarily by lightning bolts, but something akin to lightning bolts. And they died before the Eternal. And Moses said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord spoke, saying." And I want you to remember these lines in this part of verse 3. "This is what the Lord spoke." So these are God's words. "By those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy. And before all the people, I must be glorified. King James uses sanctified in place of holy and glorified. But, and either way, it means the same thing. New King James uses, must be regarded as holy, and I must be glorified when they come before me. The application of that principle to God's Sabbath, of that statement, of those, they're actually, in the New King James, they tend to put things that are more poetic, put them separately, indent them, and set them off from just the sentence after sentence version of the King James text. And that's how this is set off. Specific quote from God. By those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy, and before all the people, I must be glorified. We too must regard God as holy when we come before him. And we too must glorify God. We must regard him as absolutely holy, and he must be glorified in all that we do on the Sabbath. Nadab and Abihu, they had a responsibility of doing that from a day-to-day basis in the priesthood, because they were going in front of the temple of God on a regular basis, whenever they were on duty. So Aaron held his peace. It was a very tough time. He just saw his two oldest sons killed. He had two more. He had Eleazar, and I think the other's name was Ithamar. And Eleazar became, or Eleazar, depending on how you pronounce it, became the high priest after Aaron, and he was the high priest in Joshua's day. But these two, Nadab and Abihu, became a proverb in Israel because they had done the wrong thing. So Moses called Mishael and Elzaphan. They were the sons of Uziel, the uncle of Aaron. So these would have been Aaron's cousins, who came and took their second cousins, picked them up by the tunics, and carried them out of the camp for burial. Yeah, it was a sobering time. And he told Aaron, Moses did, you will stand your duty. Even this is a tough time, and the reaction when you see the two sons, the Israelites mourned loudly sometimes. You know, that's how they did it. We tend to try to keep it all in. We don't mourn as loudly, and yet we find a way to mourn. But that they did it more loudly. And Moses said to Aaron in verse 6, and to Eleazar and Ithamar, his sons, do not uncover your heads nor tear your clothes, lest you die. You're on duty. Stand firm. Do your duty, in essence. Lest you die and wrath come upon all the people, but let your brethren, the whole house of Israel, bewail the burning which the Lord has kindled. Let them mourn for your sons and the sin they've committed. You shall not go out from the door of the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die. For the anointing oil of the Lord is upon you. And they did according to the word of Moses. It was a critical time. Very dramatic time. Very sad time and dramatic. And yet it speaks, I think, very powerfully to us in teaching us a very important principle. Those who come near me, God says, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy. We regard God as holy. I mean, absolutely holy. And not holy in the, you know, the warm and friendly and fuzzy sense, but holy in the imposing, dynamic, and powerful sense. And before all the people, I must be glorified. You know, we can ask ourselves, how does my example live up to that? Am I, you know, trying to be an example that would help people to recognize God as holy and to ultimately glorify the true God of the Bible rather than the versions that they have. And then in verse 8, the Lord spoke to Aaron saying, do not drink wine or any intoxicating drink, you or your sons with you, when you go into the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die. I suspect because of the addition of this particular regulation that alcohol had something to do with the foolishness of Nadab and Abihu. Being a good old boy in ancient Israel wasn't too wise. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations that you may distinguish between the holy and the unholy. Nadab and Abihu did not. They left their lives there in front of the temple or the tabernacle. We, brethren, are, now down in our time, we are to distinguish between the holy and the unholy. And it's the ministry's duty to teach that. It is our duty to study it at an individual level to where we can turn around and explain it to somebody else. And between the unclean and the clean, and not just unclean and unclean meats, but the principles of spiritual cleanliness. And that you may teach the children of Israel all the statutes that the Lord has spoken to them by the hand of Moses. It is the duty of the church to teach God's way on the Sabbath, to declare what is holy, what is unholy, to identify what is clean and what is not clean, and to not be intoxicated while doing that, clear-minded. The example of Nadab and Abihu is one for the mulling, for sure, and reflecting. It's a profound lesson for us. And you wonder, well, why was it written about? Well, Paul answered that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Why this kind of story was included, why the history of Israel was included in the Bible. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. You read through the first 10 verses, and you read about the crossing of the Red Sea, which was a symbolic baptism of the Israelites. They were surrounded by water to the left of them, water to the right of them, the cloud above them, water vapor. They passed through the sea. They were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. But God was not pleased with their conduct. And then there's a big, long paragraph of all the wrong things they did out in the wandering years. And then we come down to verse 11. Now all these things, including what Nadab and Abihu did, all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. This is why we studied the Old Testament as well as the New. It is the book of precedent for the New Testament. The New Testament flows from the Old Testament. It is the book of profound lessons and the great principles of God's law. And it's just downright fascinating. And, you know, it's a history to study, spiritual history. But it should speak to us very loudly and change and influence the way in which we conduct ourselves. Now, let's go to 1 Corinthians, since we're there, to chapter 14. And here we have some instruction about the conduct of the services. Some of it is in principle, some of it is more specific. Paul is talking about speaking in tongues in the early part of the chapter, and by tongues it is not what was normally thought to be speaking in tongues in Pentecostal organizations at all. This is speaking in languages you never studied before. It is also some who naturally have the ability to do that. The Apostle Paul, in that chapter, actually tells the brethren in Corinth, well, why Corinth? Well, Corinth was a port city, so it had a very cosmopolitan population, and thus the congregation reflected that. It had people from many different areas because it was a port city. Back and forth, goods came and went, and fortunes were made there. Consequently, brethren called there might speak Egyptian. Others Greek, others Latin, others Aramaic and Hebrew, some Scythian, and whatever other languages you can come up with back in the day. So there was a need for interpreters to interpret. Some people could speak in one thing, but you had sections of the congregation that didn't understand that language. However, you had some people who could translate or interpret. And so they had to interpret. And if somebody was to give a message, but he only could speak in a certain language, and there was nobody there that day that could give the interpretation, then you have to wait. It's no use to talk to us in Swahili when none of us have ever been to Kenya, let alone learn Swahili. But now let's look at the example of how this translates into the principles of the order of God's church on the Sabbath service. The church service, or the Sabbath service, as we often call it. How is it then, brethren, in verse 26, whenever you come together, okay, we're coming together, one of the primary times the church comes together the brethren come together is on the Sabbath service. Each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation. Let all things be done for edification. If anyone speaks in a tongue, let there be two or three, the most three, each in turn, and let one interpret. Let somebody else interpret so we can understand them. And you think, well, why did they have so many that, you know, might bring a psalm or an explanation or this or that or the other thing? The core of all of Paul's congregations, just a car alarm, the core of all of Paul's congregations was Jewish. Remember, he said, I go to the Jew first and then to the Gentiles? And you might ask, why would he do that? Why would he go to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles? And the answer is this. They had no Bibles. You couldn't go down to the local Bible bookstore and buy a Bible if you were a Gentile. What you could do, however, is make friends with a Jewish fellow who knew his Bible. So you needed a core of Jews for God to call first in a congregation in the Gentile world. They then were a resource, a repository of scriptural knowledge, because the congregation couldn't hope to afford even a single scroll of the Old Testament, and it was written in many scrolls, big, long scrolls that were highly expensive. So you had to have the Jews first so the Gentiles could have Bible study. They could discuss things with the Jewish brethren. Now, so therefore you're going to have, with those educated Jews, to start with, you're going to have a lot of men who have the capability of giving messages. And gradually, Gentile men as well. But if there is no interpreter, verse 28, we talked about that, let him be silent in the church and keep himself to himself and God. Let two or three prophets speak, let the others judge. Listen and learn. You know, so you have the lesson here. Everybody takes turns. If two or three speakers, they listen attentively, and, you know, in the sense of judging and analyzing and learning from it. For you can all prophesy, but one by one, that all may learn and come to be encouraged. But bear this in mind. The spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. You don't get carried away in crazy emotionalism. And yet we see that in a lot of variations of Christianity down through the ages. Emotionalism is what they have. That is what they have. They don't have a knowledge base of significance. They have emotional pull. They get carried away with the emotions. It leads them into more doctrinal errors. But we know that. But we're specifically told that the spirits of the prophets, those who are the speakers, in this case, the prophesiers, which means, as I pointed out in the pastor's note, to prophesy had two meanings. One is to foretell future events. But in the New Testament, it was most often meant to speak forth. In other words, to declare God's will or God's counsel on the subject from the Scripture. So it was speaking. But everybody needs to be thoughtful and well in control of their emotions. For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. So you must have had some scenes on some Sabbaths in Corinth for Paul to give this specific correction, where you had a cacophony of people speaking and talking in this language or that language and wanting others to listen to them, and two or three going on at the same time. No way. You're going to stop that right away. So the Apostle Paul gave a sermon on Sabbath keeping. Let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive, as the law also says. If they want to learn something, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is shameful for women to speak in the church. And so we have a male ministry as directed by God in the church. We have a time when people can ask questions. It's not during church services. In Bible studies, we always have the written questions, but sometimes we do Bible classes, which are designed to be interactive, where it isn't the church service, so it's a class, and we field questions on a regular basis. Or did the word of God come originally from you? Or was it from you only that it reached? If anyone thinks himself to be a prophet or spiritual, let him acknowledge the things which I write to you are commandments of the Lord. But if anyone is ignorant, let him be ignorant. You know, make your choice. Therefore, brethren, desire earnestly to prophesy, and do not forbid to speak in other languages, in tongues. Let all things be done decently and in order. So even those who didn't know Latin or Greek could, but who were capable of giving a message, could give the message as long as they had somebody to interpret it. Decently and in order. God is not the author of confusion, but of peace. This is then the guiding principle of God's Sabbath service. Attentive listening, no interruptions, atmosphere of learning and encouragement, a peaceful spirit, no confusion. Orderliness before, during, and after the service. So we have then a great deal of instruction. Now let's look at another parable. Here's another story to look at. This is in Matthew 22, which gives us a lesson. And we'll harp back to Nadab and Abihu and Aaron as well. Matthew 22. It begins in verse 1. Sometimes it's called the parable of the wedding feast. And Jesus answered, and he spoke to them again by parables, and he said, "The kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son and sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding, and they were not willing to come. He sent out his servants and tell everybody, okay, it's time for the wedding, and we're not going to come. Don't want to come. They weren't willing to come. So in verse 4, again, he sent out other servants. Well, if you can't get through them, we'll try you bunch over here. Other servants saying, tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and fatted cattle are killed. All things are ready. Come to the wedding. And you think, well, hold it. You mean you already got the animals slaughtered? Yes. And how long is that meat going to stay good without refrigeration? Come to the wedding. You know, they got the fire, the glowing coals underneath. The barbecue has begun. And I say barbecue, that would be how you would often cook a whole beef. And it's only going to be a number of hours before it's time to eat. And there are many things that have to occur during the wedding feast before that happens. But what did the people do that were invited? They made light of it. They went their ways, one to his farm, another to his business, and the rest seized his servants and treated them spitefully and killed them. Is that any way to treat those servants of one who wants you to come and dine with him at a great wedding feast? When the king heard about that, he was furious. Well, he should be. And he sent out his armies, and he destroyed those murderers and burned up their city. Then he said to his servants, the wedding is ready. Those who were invited were not worthy. Therefore, go into the highways, and as many as you can find, invite to the wedding. So those servants went out to the highways and gathered together all that they found, and both bad and good, and the wedding hall was filled with guests. So they came. And, you know, the parable could end there, but it doesn't. So there's another lesson that's coming in verse 11. But when the king came in to see the guests, he saw a man there who did not have on a wedding garment. He wasn't dressed for the occasion. Not being dressed for the occasion was offensive. This was a great man with a great son, with a great wedding that he was providing for the people. The least this man could have done, this person here, is he could have gotten a wedding garment, appropriate clothing for the event. And he said to him, friend, how did you come in here without a wedding garment? And he was speechless. And the king said to the servants, bind him hand and foot, take him away, and throw him into outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen. It's kind of a chilling parable when you get down to it. You know, catastrophe, murder of the servants, armies sent out, a whole city burned, and then this guy. But we are to learn from the parables. And we certainly can. Let's consider, therefore, our conduct and our dress at the church service. Mark chapter 2 and verse 28 is where we'd like us to go next. Mark 2. This is the same parable we read in Matthew, but there's another line that's added in Mark. So we're just going to the summary of the parable. The parable started in verse 23, but we're going down to verse 27 and 8. And he said to them, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. It was a gift from God. Therefore, the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath." Christ rules. Where did that other parable come from that we just read? That scary one? Well, it came from Christ. So, reflecting upon that, reflecting upon the lesson of Nadab and Abihu, which is rather chilling, but it's important that we sometimes be chilled, sometimes be intimidated in a positive way. Our conduct at church services should be reverent and cheerful, respectful with each other, of course, and especially with God. It should be a time of true joyfulness, because it is the ultimate spiritual joy. That's greater than, you know, the joy that we have that something good happens to us. You know, I bought a Häagen-Dazs ice cream bar and I managed to eat it without it falling off the stick again. You know, which is always good, and getting chocolate all over everything. It's awfully a waste of chocolate. No, this is greater joyfulness than that. Peacefulness, peacefully and in order. Good fellowship. Pure language in the sense of good conversation, learning from each other, encouraging one another. You know the benefit and the beauty of that kind of conduct and that kind of conversation. Conversation actually used to be used for conduct in English. It was a term in Shakespeare's day and in the King James day where, you know, you are known by your conversation. And it doesn't just mean what you say. It meant what you say and what you do. We use now conduct for what we do, but conversation for what we say. So how do we dress when we come before God? Nadab and Abihu died in their uniforms. At least they were well-dressed for the occasion. There were specific dress codes that God gave. And again, I encourage you to read Exodus 39. And if you want to go back and sort through from chapter 40 to 48 of Ezekiel, you'll find a section that talks about how the priesthood in the millennium will be dressed. And how they will take very careful care of their uniforms. They will all be of linen. Nothing that would cause sweat when they were on duty at the temple. And likewise, that's the way it was with Aaron and with the other priesthood, whenever the priesthood was faithful in its day. And we consider how we dress. The world has become very casual in its approach to things. Talked to one of our neighbors yesterday, and he says, yeah, the world is, it's changing. He says, nobody dresses even to go to church anymore, dresses up. And just an odd comment that just happened to come out in a conversation we had yesterday. But for men, it has been the American business formal. It pretty is how we have learned it. That's basically been the standard, the business formal standard of a suit and tie or jacket and slacks and a tie for about 100 years. When you go back through the fashions, it really haven't changed for men very much. Well, you had the zoot suits in the 30s so they could pack the 45s because it was prohibition time. But the suit was basically the same suit just with holster room back in those days. So that's the way God expects us to, as men, to dress and come. For ladies, recapture the true values of modesty. It is tougher because the standards of modesty have slipped so badly. I mean, go back and think again of those decades we started talking about, the 1960s and 70s, and how dramatically that affected the styles of dress for women. Less so for men, because after they got tired of being, mockers and rockers, and the winkle pickers, those were those really pointed shoes that the English wore, and they called them winkle pickers. I have no idea. They gave names to things, and they still do, that have no rhyme or reason. It just sounds good. They were pointed-toed shoes, which were kind of elfish-looking. And odd. But he gave back a way to the standard business, American business formal, which is pretty much the same in Europe. There are a few countries where it's different. You have a different style. Not so much in the Orient, China and Japan. They have the same standard of basic business dress, business formal. But in the Philippines, they have it different. They wear a shirt suit or a shirt jacket, and it's open-necked. And that carries the same weight in their society as suit and tie in America. In Israel, you will seldom ever see a tie in Israel, but they wear jackets when they are in a formal situation, and they wear shirts that go along with that. Seldom do you see them in a tie unless they have to go, the prime minister has to go someplace. But the rest of the world has, or the bulk of it, the Western world in particular, and even much of the Orient is very similar to ours. For ladies, though, the styles have changed differently. But being dressed up in a dress or a dress, dressy slack suit, that kind of thing is certainly what God would approve of. It has to be obviously feminine and obviously modest, which, of course, is going to affect skirt length. You don't want them to be too short. Even if they're popular in society, that doesn't mean they're popular with God. You know, and as I say, women's styles go up and down and this way and that way. And we chart a course that's guided by the principles of God's way, even in the kind of clothes we choose to wear, and especially that we wear on the Sabbath. Certainly you have to be cautious about the tops because the cleavage is the all-important thing in styles today. We don't need that at church. Needs to be very modest. No strapless or spaghetti straps unless you've got a jacket with it goes along with the outfit or a shoulder scarf. I can tell you an interesting story. When we were on the trip to Israel, the one that was about a year and a half ago, we went up on the Temple Mount. And I remembered when Linda and I met in the summer we were at the dig in Jerusalem in 73, we just walk up the ramp and wander into the Temple Mount anytime we wanted. Nobody stopped, asked questions or anything. They did have law enforcement up there, the Jordanians. Israel allows Jordan to police the Temple Mount proper. Well, this time it was like going into an airport. You had a long walkway, they all constructed zigzagging up, an elevated one that was probably 300 yards long or longer, and you had to go through the body scan to make sure you weren't packing heat. And all the other things that you would typically find at an airport just to get in to the Temple Mount area. Of course, the odd thing was we got out the other end of it when we finished. We just walked away. There was a gateway, and we walked out of it. And there wasn't anybody there. But in the main entrance, the Jordanian police were running that. And we got in, and we had about 60 of us. And our guide had a microphone he was wearing, and we all had earphones on. So we would, within 100 yards, we could all hear him, which was great. You didn't miss a thing. So he stopped us just after we had cleared customs, so to speak, just gotten onto the mount. We're looking at the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque over here and a couple of other things, and he's explaining where they were and where the temple would have been back in the day. And suddenly Frank Fish, whose parents are in the Wheeling Church and who's the owns the tour service that we were with, he starts waving to Eric, our guide, move on, move on. And I was standing with Frank at the back of the crowd, and suddenly we heard this loud yelling behind us. And we turned around, and it was an American woman, youngish, in her 30s, I'm guessing. She and her husband or boyfriend, who knows what, had come up there, and they were both wearing shorts with exposed knees, and both had on sleeveless shirts. And for the Arabs, that's not modest. The shoulders must be covered, and the knees. So the way they allowed people to come in is if you didn't have your shoulders and your knees covered, they would sell you a scarf. And you tie it around your shoulders, and you tie it around your waist. Well, the guy had no problem. He did exactly what they wanted, tied around his waist and around his shoulders, and he was wandered on and left her there talking to the police and the people who were helping. And suddenly she's yelling. she's not going to wear that. And she wouldn't. They were trying to. Arab ladies were trying to have her buy one of their covering scarves so that she could be allowed in. And she got louder and louder, and that's when Frank started the group to move. We moved about 70 yards away real quickly, and then we stopped where we could talk, because you don't want to be near that. They had a riot there a couple of days earlier, which just tore things up really bad and injured people. I'm watching as we're walking, and out of one room immediately comes a squad of gray uniforms. And those were the Jordanian police. So the one on duty needed help, and they came immediately, all of them carrying their weapons. And she kept yelling and yelling. And you're like, oh, can Americans ever be reasonable when they're outside the country? It was embarrassing. But suddenly, from another room I hadn't even noticed, came about a dozen black uniforms, IDF agents, Israeli defense people. So they had the whole group, two opposite armies together, dealing with this issue, because that's what sparks riots there. But the example was a sad one, that America just lacks a sense of appropriateness, a sense of decorum, and she was just a typical example of that. So we need to look at that and make sure that as God's church here in North Canton and all of our congregations, that we're dressing appropriately for the Sabbath and conducting ourselves as we should for the Sabbath and savoring this fabulous day that God has given us to fellowship together, to converse and to talk and to share refreshments and a cup of coffee and tell the tales of how things have gone for us in this week and where God's intervened and where He needs to intervene, and please pray about it. This is a fabulous day. This is how we keep the Sabbath holy. So let's give some thought to this, reflect on these passages and scriptures, and come to savor and appreciate the opportunity that we have even more.